This is Big Ideas from the ABC.
We're going to start off beginning with Ross Garnaut, since it's his book that stimulated this, giving you an exposition on that question that was put to them of, you know, where to after the boom? Dog days after the salad days, question mark? So, Ross, over to you.
Thanks, Carmen. Well, the book Dog Days, Australia After the Boom, tells the story of, first of the extraordinary expansion of the Australian economy since the turn of the century, well, actually going back to the 91-92 recession, the longest period of expansion unbroken by recession that any developed country has ever had. Then tells the story of how that experience has left us with an economy in which costs are out of line with international levels and a political culture that finds it very difficult to make the adjustments now that are necessary if we're going to do well in the more difficult circumstances that are facing us now. I divide the long boom into two periods. The 90s was the tail end of a remarkable reform era in Australia, which I date from 83 to 2000. And I say that gave way to the great Australian complacency of the early 21st century around the turn of the century. The reform era was characterised by consistent effort in productivity-raising reform, supported by a political culture in which Australians were prepared to accept that occasionally particular interest groups had to accept that they weren't going to get what they wanted out of government in the public interest. But in the great Australian complacency, that willingness to accept some pain, some stress in the public interest disappeared, and reform disappeared, productivity growth disappeared. In the 90s, remarkably for Australia, because this hadn't been the earlier experience, we had the strongest productivity growth amongst developed countries up from the recession onwards. In the 2000s, we began with a sharp fall in productivity, so that average productivity levels today are no higher than at the beginning of the century. How did the growth in incomes, the expansion, the good times keep going without any productivity growth? Well, for the first few years of the century, higher incomes were financed by a huge housing and consumption boom, funded by our banks borrowing in international wholesale markets, the sort of things that gave the other English-speaking countries and Spain their global financial crisis. We didn't have that sad end because from about 2003, we enjoyed the benefits of the China resources boom. Now, I tell a little bit of the story of that China boom in the book. China, from 2000 until 2011, went through the strongest period of expansion that any economy has ever gone through, and it was much more metals and energy intensive than any country's growth has ever been. And it happens that Australia was the globally competitive supplier of the forms of energy and metals which where demand was growing much so strongly. And so prices of iron ore, coking coal, thermal coal,
nickel,
other metals, including nickel, went to unprecedented levels, four or five times the levels that they had been earlier. These are called, by economists, the terms of trade. They went to highest levels we've ever had. We spent that money as it came in, most of it. The surpluses that the federal government ran were very small compared with the increase in incomes. The effect of spending that money as it came in meant that the cost structure of Australia rose well above those of other countries. And what I focus on is what economists call the real exchange rate, which takes account of the exchange rate you see on the television every night, plus what's happening to relative inflation rates. And the cost level of Australia relative to the average of our trading partners rose by about 70%. again, a bigger loss of competitiveness than any developed country ever had. Now, we could support that while iron ore and coal prices were sky high. But they began to retreat in 2011. They began to retreat because the pattern of growth in China changed, and they've changed permanently. The change was firstly an easing back in the rate of growth from around 10% to around 7.5%, but much more importantly, structural change in China, more emphasis on equity and income distribution, less on investment, more concern for growth in services and consumption, and most importantly, a higher priority for environmental objectives, which in particular meant there was no significant growth in demand for thermal coal from 2011. The effect of that was to make 2011 the year of the highest export price, and they've been in retreat since then. The consequence has been a steady fall since the September quarter of 2011 in the ratio of employment to population, accumulating to a big fall in the ratio of employment to population, and very strong pressures on government budgets, federal and state. The revenues available to government have fallen sharply. Our Treasury has been surprised by that. And our state governments' treasuries have been surprised by that, Australian government's budgets are hugely weaker now than in 2011, and we're only early in this process of unwinding the resources boom. The peak of the boom in terms of effects on Australian capacity to support expenditure was in 2011. It's been downhill since then, but we're only part of the way downhill is going to keep going. Now, I pose the choice facing Australia as one between a return to policies focused on the public interest and a continuation of the great Australian complacency where private interests are able to veto things that they don't like. And I'm talking about business private interests, but also the interests in households resisting any adjustments. Households have benefited from that huge expansion of middle-class welfare are resisting any adjustment to that. Businesses were given benefits, tax concessions, the like of which had never been contemplated before during the boom, and they've now been seen as property rights by business, with business saying we've got to be compensated if these mistakes in policy are corrected. This is private interest oriented policy. It's very hard to break that. The current rhetoric of the Treasurer on the end of the age of entitlement is necessary as part of the correction, but so far the current government is focused only on removing entitlements from a very narrow part of the population and not removing any of the entitlements to their support base. And I don't think that can work politically or economically. It's too narrow a base to work economically, but I doubt that this can work politically. And so we've got to change that, get back to a more broadly based public interest approach to policy to correct it. WA shares Australia's adjustment challenge, but it's got the challenge in higher degree than others. Western Australia benefited hugely from the resources boom in the revenues from iron ore from the high prices. That's been challenged since then. WA, like the Commonwealth, like the other state governments, spent the proceeds of the boom as they came in, didn't put any aside for the future adjustment, and now the boom's not there in the same way that it was before and has to cut back, and so that felt very strongly in West Australia. Felt worse in West Australia because our system of federal state financial relations means that after a few years, any increase in revenue to West Australia gets taken away and equalised across the state. So the revenue available to the state government is actually falling faster than the revenue itself is falling. Mm. And I think this is a big barrier to Western Australia making a smooth adjustment to the end of the mining boom.
Thank you very much, Ross. Now we'll go around this way if that's okay. So, Andrew, yes, thank you.
Thank you. So while Ross's story focuses very much on what's happened to average incomes in Australia, mine focuses on what's happened to the distribution of incomes in Australia. And let me give you a simple metaphor to think about that. Imagine a ladder in which every rung represents $1 million of household wealth. On that ladder, the average Australian household is closer to the ground than they are to the first rung. If you're in the top 10% of the population, you're about 1.5 rungs up, I guess maybe about there. If you're in the top 1% of the population, you're about 5 rungs up, about as tall as one of us panellists would be if we stood up. On that ladder, Gina Rinehart is 10 kilometres off the ground. And so a country which has always had a strongly egalitarian spirit, where we use mate rather than sir, where we sit in the front seat of taxis and don't like tipping, where we don't stand up when the Prime Minister enters the room, and where we've had central bank governors called Nugget and Nobby. A nation that, when its soldiers were facing the privations of Japanese prisoner of war camps, formed what one historian has called little male-bonded welfare states. That nation has seen a significant rise in inequality. It's seen a doubling of the top 1% share and a tripling of the top 0.1% share. The earnings for those in the bottom 10% have grown after inflation in the last 35 years. But they've grown at about a third of the rate of earnings in the top 10%. CEO salaries over the last couple of decades have tripled from about $1 to about $3 million. And inequality's risen even among the very elite. If all you had to measure inequality in Australia with a BRW magazine, all you had was the 1984 one, the 2013 one, you would observe that in the 2013 magazine, the top quarter had 75% of the total wealth, compared to the 1984 magazine, where the top quarter only had two-thirds of the wealth. So inequality is rising even at the very tippy top. You can see it in the consumption statistics, rapid rises in the prices of waterfront homes and great Australian artworks, doubling in Porsche sales and a quintupling in Maserati sales. Even cocaine, what Robin Williams once called God's way of telling you you're making too much money. Even cocaine sales have increased significantly over the last couple of decades. And here in Western Australia, you've seen the most rapid rise of all. Western Australia's inequality used to be about the same as the average across Australia. And now the level of inequality in Western Australia is the highest in Australia and places you similar to the United States, where Australia as a whole is in about the top one-third of inequality for developed countries. The US is at the top. And so Western Australia has not only increased average incomes, but also increased the dispersion of incomes. The challenge now is how to deal with that rising gap, if you think it's a problem, without decreasing overall living standards. And the effects that got us here, technology, globalisation, cuts in top tax rates, are probably not by and large effects that many people would like to just wind backwards. We've seen lower unionisation rates, but that's largely because we took away closed shops, and I don't think anyone wants closed shops back again. So we need some creative solutions if we're to narrow the gap between rich and poor.
Thank you very much, Andrew. We'll just keep going around. Scott.
Thanks, Carmen. Thanks, everyone, for coming out. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to read the book yet, but I've found it quite a valuable and sobering contribution to the debate. I've lived in this state for most of my life, and knowing a little bit about Western Australian history, since 1829, it has been something of a boom and bust state. And you can see, and you need to go down the west end of Fremantle to see the gold rush boom and the money that was spent in our old colonial port. and then look at the towers on the skyline today and see how the money's being spent in this boom in the 21st century. I think it's useful, if we had all night, probably you'd have time for more of a critique. It's useful in the sense that it points out that the party is over and does attempt, even in our political culture and climate, to point to some ways in which we might soften the landing somewhat. In some societies of the past, they didn't fiddle with tax rates. They brought guillotines out when inequality reached those sorts of levels. Not that that's Green's policy, by the way. But interesting to think about it, though, isn't it? the other thing that I think the book's really valuable for, although I've found the tone disturbingly polite, is the power of vested interests and how difficult it is to do reform. Professor Garnaut, I guess being a little bit modest, had a seat at the table when the Clean Energy Act was written. You might know the Clean Energy Act by its more formal title of Julia Gillard's Toxic Carbon Tax. That is driving greenhouse gas emissions down in the sectors of the economy where it's covered. It's added more than $6 billion a year to the budget bottom line. It's delivering $10 billion over 5 years into building the next generation of renewable power stations. They changed the tax codes to protect people on low and middle incomes from the increase, the small increase in the cost of living that I think Treasury correctly predicted was about a third of the impact of the GST. And it's funding things like the Biodiversity Fund, and it's funding things like energy efficiency and businesses getting more productive. And the reason I'm going into a bit of detail about that is that that policy has been under profound and sustained attack by three-word slogans and very powerful vested interests with big megaphones since it passed into law. And Western Australia is in a position, actually, as of yesterday morning, of being able to do something about that because that package, or parts of it at least, hang by a thread of one vote that this state can deliver in the next 6 to 10 weeks. But the point being that that is public interest policy. I would strongly argue that that is public interest policy. If you want to know what, you know, taxing the bads, supporting the goods, protecting people who are vulnerable, that's how it looks when you do that kind of reform. And it's being belted. It's really being belted. And whether or not we can keep it on the statute books and actually drive that transition to renewable energy is very much an open question. The other thing that the book, I guess, delivers to us is something of a sense of urgency. I guess I think I'm the only non-economics PhD up here, so it feels a little bit... I'm a graphic designer, actually, so, you know, for what it's worth. I think, in a way, if we go looking for ways of kinder, gentler capitalism, we're probably going to be really disappointed. One of the things I'm most interested in is the prospects for being able to maintain and sustain growth in the age of climate change. We've breached profoundly important biophysical limits in the underlying ecosystem that sustains us and keeps the air and water clean. If you look at the progress of the material economy during the 20th and early 21st centuries, it doubles in material impact about once every 25 years. It's twice as aggressive about once every generation, twice the scale, twice the impact. Hits fish, fresh water, oil, coal resources, iron ore resources twice as hard, which means every 25 years it's consuming more than in all previous history combined. And my instinct, and there is some data to support the fact that we're not going to see that next doubling. You could argue that that tapering that's occurring in China is the signature of that. The coal dust from the coking and thermal coal that we sell to Chinese people kills 1 million people a year, shortens lives measurably in the areas where the impact is heaviest. We cannot and will not, I don't believe, be able to sustain the kind of economic growth that our economists all believe has to continue doubling on into perpetuity. And we've built an economy that says you either grow or you die. You either maintain that 3% annual compounding output, which buys you a doubling every 25 years, or you slide into recession and half of the people in this auditorium are thrown out of work. We need some alternate form of economic progress that can sustain us without chewing down the underlying biosphere. And so I'm very interested in closed-loop economics or conservator economics, forms of economic development that aren't necessarily premised on double material throughput every 25 years, which is the society that we live in at the moment. So I suppose most of what we do, although it's difficult, can be difficult arguments to sustain in a sort of bumper sticker politics that we're engaged in at the moment, is a form of shockproofing for a soft landing. There are profoundly important reform proposals in this book that I suspect won't see the light of day, certainly not under this government. They are not governing in the public interest at all. So what we are mostly engaged in doing is trying to create resilience in that crash pad for when the place hits the wall, which it must do sooner or later. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Scott. Andrew.
I don't have a manifesto or anything like that. I think I'm here as the sort of independent journalist voice. I've covered the WA resources boom since 2006, as Carmen said. So I've seen all the colourful characters and the companies and the spivs and the honest business people too. And I've there's been scandals, there's been great successes, there's been millions of dollars made, and it's been a great story. But I guess the last 6 months have been different, and a different kind of story to tell from Perth for a national audience. And this goes to sort of Ross's book, I suppose. Just as an example, today my assignment as a reporter was to go and cover a creditors meeting for Forge Group, which collapsed last week, which most of you have probably heard about. There's 1,600 employees who were turfed out of their job. There's creditors owed tens of millions of dollars. It's a bit of a sob story. It's a sort of classic sign of the end of the boom. Companies that aren't very well run start to collapse. I spoke to workers there who think they'll never receive their wages and their entitlements. There's 1,600 workers at this company who don't have a job. I spoke to creditors. I spoke to a guy who is owed $4.8 million from Forge and he's worried about losing his house. His wife is sick, she's so stressed. It's a highly stressful time for this guy who's owed $4.8 million and he's joined the queue to try and claw back some of this money. So I guess having covered the boom years in Perth, it's now kind of a different story. After I covered the Forge creditors meeting and sat through that, and I came back to the office and I opened the Fin Review, which is the rival publication of The Australian, but a paper I used to work for, and I was just reading a story in there this morning which said, because at the moment we're sort of in the middle of profit reporting season in Australia, so all these companies are reporting their half-year profits, and I think this story kind of brought together just what the end of the boom and the sort of the downturn in mining is doing, not just to mining companies and mining services companies like Forge, but to companies throughout the economy. And I just happened to be reading it this morning. It said that yesterday the retailer Super Retail Group, which has all sorts of stores like Boating, Camping and Fishing, or BCF, said that the resources slowdown has really buffeted its chain, has cashed up mine workers in regional areas, close up their wallets. It then talked about Ansell, the glove and condom maker. It said was another company seemingly removed from mining that has also been hurt by the slowdown. you've got to remember, gloves and condoms are, in demand on mine sites. And actually, it does say here, the company has its product in a variety of areas on mine sites. Sims Metal Management, which shreds, recycles and sells scrap metal, was another to express concern about the downturn in mining investment. Property group Aspen, well known in Perth, took a big write-down on Septimus Row office building in Perth due to softening conditions in the Perth CBD office market. Of course, vacancy rates are going up rapidly in both Perth and in West Perth. Anyone who's walked around West Perth in the last few weeks would see the proliferation of for lease signs outside of so many buildings in West Perth as so many mining companies or mining services companies have moved out. So that was sort of the first half of my day today, and I think it really just encapsulates where we are in the economy, particularly in Western Australia and in Australia, and the effects that the slowdown in mining in WA are having nationally. But it's not all doom and gloom. It's not sort of the end of the boom. It's the end of a particular phase of the boom, the mining investment boom. There's still a lot of activity going on. We're entering a mining export boom and a resources export boom. I mean, the best description I've heard recently was about what's happened to the economy was someone said to me, it's a bit like if you're travelling down the freeway at 120 kilometres an hour and then you suddenly slow down to 80. And it does feel slow for a while, but then you sort of you get used to it and it feels like you're travelling okay. So I think that's what's happened. If you look up, and talking about profit reporting season, all the big mining companies just this past week, BHP, Rio Tinto, Fortescue, have all come out and said they're exporting record amounts of iron ore. Iron ore prices are still very strong. There's still a lot of activity going on. Mining's still a massive industry. We shouldn't think that it's suddenly dying. It's going to continue to be the core industry in this state, particularly for some time. So I guess there's two parts to the story. Yes, things are slowing down. Yes, there's these terrible stories that are going on about people being thrown out of work. But there's big parts of the industry are still powering on.
Thank you, Andrew. And thanks for your patience, Mike.
That's my pleasure. A couple of things. I don't have a grand plan. I'm a free marketer, so I let things work its way through. But just a comments on the way through. We, as Ross made clear, in Australia, have been the beneficiary of the greatest boom on earth. China, the largest country on earth, experienced the largest sustained boom on earth. We're at the end of the conveyor belt for them, and we've benefited from it. We've seen massive expansion in capacity to meet their demands for resources, and as Ross correctly pointed out, China's was a very intensive resource expansion, because what they did is moved 500 million people from the countryside to the cities and built their cities anew and built transport systems, you name it. Just massive. I started going to China in 1992 and went every year for about 13 years and saw that change. And we were lucky. We had existing infrastructure in the mining sector. We had stable property rights. We had very good firms that could respond to that demand quickly. There was, besides Brazil, no one else expanded to the, responded in essence to the iron ore boom. We did. Our iron ore prices went from, my memory is about $30 a ton to about $180 to $190. That's led to expansion of it, but the firms who already had existing capacity benefited immensely. Their prices on their existing production went from $30 to $190. They also, important, which is shifted the pricing arrangement, so they used to have long-term contracts. They went to spot market. So there's huge gains in this. Same thing happened across the board. You know what my response is? Aren't we bloody lucky? And weren't we right in doing a whole range of things, much of what Ross has pointed out in the 80s, in the 90s, the reform agenda was all not explicitly planned for them, but if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't have gotten the boom. Because in the 80s, in the 70s, when we had the large fights about protectionism, about restrictions on trade, all sorts of reforms and floating exchange rate, those were largely driven so we could enhance our competitive advantage in the sectors we were most competitive in, and they were mining. And I remember when I came to Australia getting involved early on in this issue was the mining sector, who were complaining most about protectionism because the way tariffs work, they were bearing the costs of it. And so we did a whole range of things that positioned ourselves to take advantage of this boom. And if we hadn't done it, we wouldn't have it. And I also have, I know Ross was intimately involved in the floating of exchange rate way back in, what, 83? 83. Colleagues of mine, erstwhile, were resisted that. So we made a whole range of changes during that period that benefited us. And I've been a commentator before I got into politics, and I've watched the exchange rate go up and down like a yo-yo, one of the most volatile exchange rates, because for a small nation, it's heavily traded. And I've seen it go down to about 49 and then back up more recently to 110. The thing that I've been amazed at, the ability of the economy to cope with that fluctuations in exchange rates. I've always been amazed at it. It's painful, but that works. So I think we have a more adjustment. And then I've watched us go through the recession we had to have. the collapse of the tiger economies, the collapse of the dot-com boom, the withstanding of the mining boom. We have a much more flexible economy than we think. That aside, what Ross pointed out to is do I think there's going to be dogs day? No, I don't. I think we have a lot of adjustment to do, but I'm confident we can. And my dog, by the way, is a very happy and pleasant dog. But I will, a couple of things I support. One strongly is that there's a whole range of young people out there who have never known difficult times since 91, 92. It's always been up and up, up and up. Life brings experiences. And also, we've had a great deal of inflation in certain commodities. Ross deals with this in its land for houses. That is absorbed of a lot of our investment, and a lot of it is wasteful. Okay? It isn't because we gave people money and we made them wealthy. It's because we have put in all sorts of restrictions on access to land, and both whether it's on edge of the city or uprise. Try to build a high-rise in this city. Very difficult. Takes 5 years, and the minimum price you can build for a three-bedroom apartment is $600,000. That's not a low-cost house. So we've had some issues. As to one of the issues is the power vested interests, okay? It's real, okay? It is real on all sides. Again, I go back to when I came into the debate in the early 80s, the mining sector were the largest proponents in the business side for reform that Ross talks about because they were suffering the consequences for it. There has been some changes more recently, and Ross talks about the economists, which I agree. The business sector have become more global. Our mining firms are not Australian anymore, except for Twiggy and Gina to some extent. They're global. They're policy takers. They're not going to fight these battles, except if it's in their interest. Economists, most of them, Ross is a great exception, are dealing in an international game. Publisher perish in international journals. We do have a lack of institutional structures that focus on Australia and Australian reform. Interest on the other side, I'm the Minister for Energy here, and I have a conga team of renewable energy supporters, promoters, outside my door every day. And they're not poor. They have banks that begin with N and M and you name it. They're supporting both sides because they make money. It's pursuit of money. So I don't think I think we have a institutional problem with focus on policy in Australia, and we could debate whether we have a lopsided public interest issue, but we do definitely have a lack of institutional structure that follow debate. The Business Council isn't the Business Council of the 1980s. A couple of other issues I'd like to emphasize. In WA, we are a little bit different, I guess, listen to others. The biggest beneficiary is boom. Yeah, Gina went from $70 million she inherited her father to, what, $10, $20 billion? I don't know. Am I jealous? No. Am I jealous of my struggling brother has tried to be an actor and never made any money, but Tom Cruise makes $250 million a year? No. Not at all. But the biggest beneficiary of the boom is these people who have been derided as cashed-up bogans. The many, many, many people who are on $150,000 a year, electricians and plumbers and builders' laborers and whatnot, the thousands of the 65,000 people who fly to the mine sites from the airport in Perth every week who inhabit my electorate. Have they done well out of the boom? You better believe it. They have some have wasted it, some have bought a house, some have invested it wisely. But this boom in Western Australia at this phase, in the construction phase, has been egalitarian, more egalitarian than any other boom that I can see, whether it's the Asian boom, whether it's the U.S. IT boom, whether it has benefited working-class people like no other boom I had. Yes, they're not as rich as Twiggy and Gina, but to them, they've done well. They've done very well indeed. As to how do we adjust from here, Western Australia has this strange thing to the Grants Commission where every dollar we earn above the level, whether it's mining royalties or payroll tax, gets equalized and transferred largely to Tasmania and South Australia and Northern Territory and the ACT, despite the ACT being the wealthiest city in Australia on average incomes. But we have some institutional problems where if we had to go out and invest in infrastructure in advance of mining, whether it's a road to the north or what to help the growth of population here, which has been growing at 3.5%, to work in the mines, we have seen a great deal of that taken off Western Australia and put it elsewhere. We've come out of this boom with a great deal of debt. It's ironic. But do we have some adjustments to do what Ross talks about? You better believe it. This has been yes. Will we work through it? I'm confident we will.
Okay. Mike, we might draw a conclusion to you there, if that's okay, because we did agree to time. So, Andrew, did you want to comment? And others may wish to as well.
Well, I just wanted to kind of quickly sum up what the panel has told you so far. Less thermal coal and less condoms. However, more carbon price, more cocaine and more conga lines.
I think you'll be still very patient, Andrew. So everyone's had taken a very different slice of the issues surrounding the question that we've posed today, you know, whether we've been through a boom and if so, who benefited and what likely consequences are. Please feel free to comment. But one of the things that I think hasn't been stressed, and as somebody who's, I think, always thought of myself not as a West Australian first but as an Australian first and a West Australian second, I'm also interested in the impact that this has had on other parts of the country. And we've just seen some very dramatic declines in manufacturing, for instance, which have been on the back of some slower declines in that sector. We've had problems in education. There have been sectors that haven't been winners in this, and I wonder if any of you want to comment on that or take up some other point entirely, but that seems to me something that's worth thinking about for a national audience particularly.
Yeah, if I can come in on that, Carmen. The very high real exchange rate, the high cost level that's been driven by the boom has made all other exporting and import competing industries relatively uncompetitive. From the beginning of the reform era in 83 until 2003, we had very rapid expansion of manufactured exports and services exports. Whole huge new export industries emerged. There were no exports of education services until the reforms of the mid-80s. By the early 21st century, education, taking in fee-paying students, was our third biggest export industry after iron ore and coal.
And a big employer.
Generating huge employment and good jobs in Australia's universities and education sector. That boom in that consistent, very strong growth in double digits from 83 to 2003 stopped then. And I've got a couple of graphs in to illustrate the point in dog days. At the beginning of the reform era, 83, we imported more grog than we exported. Imports of champagne and Scotch whisky exceeded our exports of wine. By 2003, that was the peak, the net exports, the excess of exports of grog over imports of grog, represented 0.4% of GDP. Now, that's huge for a small industry, equivalent to about $5 billion. So we went from drinking champagne to drinking Coonawarra or Margaret River, but that all went into reverse. And so we're back to having zero net exports today. We've effectively drunk that huge...
what a great metaphor.
And you get a very similar story with almost all exports. Look at processed foodstuffs. Big boom, decline. Now, that's what you expect from a very big boom in one sector, a boom of the scale we've had. It raises the cost level, it cuts off every industry. Every mine that was opened when we had full employment meant that, a lot of fanfare about the opening of mine, that it meant that somewhere in Australia a university department closed, or a tourist hotel closed, or a factory closed. That was unannounced. But that's the process. The only way to... And that would be fine for the Australian standard of living if the very high export price were going to last forever.
Or were captured in some way, Ross?
But it's not fine if they're not going to last forever. And if they're not going to last forever, you need to capture them and save them so that they're available for use when the boom ends. And the big mistake we made was in spending this revenue as it came, letting that drive up the real exchange rate, and so the cost level made everything else uncompetitive. Now, Mike is right to a point about the floating dollar, and I'll defend the floating dollar probably for the rest of my days. But when you spend the proceeds of a boom like this as it comes in and drive the dollar up, it's not a painless process adjusting to the lower dollar. It's much better to avoid the big increase in cost by capturing and saving the revenue on the way up. And while the dollar will come down, it's not coming down as quickly as is necessary to keep our competitiveness in shape as the boom recedes into history. Partly because since 2011 we've been unlucky. We're running into some extraordinary monetary policy in other countries. That's in right. The United States, Japan, Europe, the United Kingdom. They are pumping money into their economy so that the dollar hasn't come down in the way that normally would. And so we have to do something special to get a timely reduction in the real exchange rate. And when it does come, not a painless process. The price of all those imported things that we've had so cheap, BMWs and iPads and shoes,
petrol,
and French champagne, become much more expensive.
Well, not just luxury goods.
Things, yes.
Petrol, for example. We're going to realise how car dependent this town is if we devalue the dollar. Mm. And if I could just speak for, you know, not everybody in this town or in this state is on a mining wage. I take Mike's point that, you know, there's a whole generation of people who've never known anything but an expanding economy. There's also a whole generation of young people who will never, ever be able to afford to buy their own home unless there's a gruesome real estate crash. And if no one else is going to mention it, I will. We also have some of the worst Aboriginal poverty and disadvantage parked side by side with some of the most lucrative resource extraction plants in the country. So, taking your point, Carmen, about, you know, how does this look from the national economy, it's also very difficult when one sector is doing so exceptionally well, for example, to find people who could be bothered to work on a farm. You know, why would you? You go and earn $180,000 a year driving a truck in Newman. Why would you bring a wheat crop in? So it's actually distorted things within Australia within Western Australia quite severely, hollowed out other sectors like education. We don't have an auto manufacturing industry here. But it's very difficult to find anybody who would account for the opportunity cost of some of the things that haven't happened while this particular industry has been going, you know, gangbusters, blowing up mountains.
And I think the thing you're noticing at the moment is one of the things that America's been seeing for a while, with the rate of economic growth doing much better than the labour market. And so Australia's labour market is at the moment languishing. So just since August last year, we're down 7,000 jobs overall, 60,000 full-time jobs. And part of that's the construction phase of the mining boom coming off, and part of it's manufacturing jobs coming off as well. And I think very much we've got to be on the front foot in terms of where the next set of jobs are going to come from. And that means you've really got to get the school system humming, tertiary and vocational education going better than we have been. That demand-driven university system's absolutely vital. And infrastructure, whether that's urban rail projects in Perth, whether that's a national broadband network that helps entrepreneurs start small businesses, infrastructure, education, and better engagement with Asia has got to be vital for making sure we don't go into a long period of sustained joblessness.
Andrew, did you want to comment at all, given Twiggy's engagement with the Indigenous employment on the issue that Scott raised?
Look, Twiggy, as I've documented in the book, I mean, he sees himself as being a great friend of the Aboriginal people. He grew up on Mindaroo Station in the Pilbara with Aboriginal kids. He played with them on the banks of the Ashburton River, and his mentors were Aboriginal stockmen. He's always said that he feels a great affinity for Aboriginal people. He has championed Indigenous employment at Fortescue and at his previous companies. But a lot of people see things a bit more complexity than that. I mean, there's a group of people up in the Pilbara called the Yindjibarndi people who have been treated pretty badly and pretty poorly, and they've been left behind, I think. The criticism of Twiggy and other mining magnates is they're great friends of the Aboriginal people until the Aboriginal people get in the way of building a mine. And I think that's Twiggy. I mean, it's hard to fault his good intentions because he does want to do good, and I think he wants to do good in so many other areas as well. But it's just the way he goes about it that attracts controversy, and that's sort of one of the issues that I think makes him a fascinating character and one of the important figures of the boom.
One of the colourful characters that we seem to have in every occasion. You mentioned education as being critical, and a lot of the discussion out of the, if you like, collapse of manufacturing, or maybe that's too strong a word, but certainly a significant decline in the associated industries, is that we'll have to do things more cleverly. There has to be innovation. There has to be, if you like, a greater capacity by the community to respond. But for me, that doesn't answer the question of what are those jobs going to be? What do they look like? I've heard a lot of blah about productivity and competitiveness, but I haven't, I must say, heard any specifics about what those jobs are likely to be.
So if you look at some of the employment growth sectors of the past decade, they're things like healthcare, education, financial services. Some of our sort of nimble architecture firms, for example, a Brisbane firm that specialises in building stadiums in China. And one of the things we were trying to do as the former government with the Australia and the Asian Century White Paper was in some sense to lay out the optimistic vision for where Australia is in this moment of history and given our geography. But, I mean, if you want two statistics that keep me awake at night, the first is that our test scores for kids aged 15 have flatlined or maybe even gone backwards over the last generation. And the second is that on innovation, we don't seem to, for example, patent as many products as the typical developed country. So the needs of a smart country aren't being met on some of those fundamental levels, and that's why I'm so passionate about getting the education system right and getting the infrastructure system going, not just roads, not just rail, but also broadband as well.
Mm-hmm. Can I chuck a couple in?
Yes,
coming?
And then,
in terms of practical stuff, we had some consultants model for us because we wanted to know what it would cost, but what it would take to do 100% renewable energy for the South West grid, which Mike's responsible for. And I gather you've been briefed on this because we FOI'd it, so that's good to know. But the study was called Energy 2029, and out to the year 2029, which would be the 200th anniversary of the establishment of the Swan River Colony, you could provide or create, these guys estimated, 26,000 jobs in completely, and it's not kind of closing everything down and building everything from scratch, but the natural retirement cycle of fossil generators that we have to retire, replacing it with baseload solar, thermal, wave energy generators, wind, rooftop PV. It's 26,000 jobs. That's a really urgent necessity that's very jobs rich. It's actually, you'd end up with a lot more people employed in the energy sector. Affordable housing is the other one. Really innovative prefab manufacturing technology in the US and elsewhere is employing a lot of people coming out of the auto industry because the engineering is very similar, the production line processes, the computer-aided design. We could be building that kind of kit here in WA using plantation timber. That's a very jobs-rich agenda as well. And I agree with Andrew, telecommunications, another really, really big one, which is why what's happened to the NBN is so sad. We will get it back on track, but those are three right out of the box, I think, that we should target. And it kind of breaks my heart when you hear the PM telling an audience at Davos, for heaven's sake, quite a sophisticated audience, no country's ever taxed or subsidised its way to prosperity, you know, apart from Singapore and, you know, Japan and Scandinavia and South Korea and North America and Canada.
There's a very long list of exceptions.
For God's sake.
So, Ross, you were wanting to comment
one point I make strongly in dog days is that a proportion of the new jobs have to be in export or import competing industries. If we just do it all on industries for the domestic market, expand domestic expenditure and without the exports, then we will run into external constraints, external payments issues. So a fair proportion has to be in those activities. And the mining, the growth in mining exports, apart from not generating many jobs, just won't be strong enough to carry the external accounts. And we won't get the growth in exports outside mining without a big fall in the real exchange rate. At the University of Melbourne, where I am now, and at UWA, we have great engineering degrees, they're attractive to international students. But they're more expensive than an engineering degree when you take into account the cost of living than an engineering degree at Imperial College London or Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And while we can say our degrees are better than them, we can't say they were so much better it's worth paying 20 or 25% more in the total costs of keeping the student for a couple of years. So to get growth in the export component of education, of tourism, of specialised manufacturers like your... new forms of housing, we're going to have to get down that real exchange rate. So this general economic adjustment has to be an important part of the story.
Mm. You better put some public transport in then.
Mike?
I'd like to... the Aboriginal issues was raised. I was for a while the Parsec and Aboriginal Affairs in this state. Went to visit most of the communities. Been around for a while. Aboriginal disadvantage is not new. It preceded the boom. If you go and talk to Aboriginals and to the mining sector way back in the 90s when the mining sector wasn't doing well, they, for reasons probably of interest, personal interest, they decided to hire put a great deal of focus on hiring Aboriginals, Rio, BHP. I think you were involved with part of that, my memory. I was, with Rio and their foundation, and they have significantly increased the employment of Aboriginals in the mining sector. It's logical for them. The land that they work on is often owned by Aboriginals, and Aboriginals make up a lot of the community. That, I hope, is made inroads to Aboriginal disadvantage, but to saying the mining sector is the cause or implying it is very dangerous because it stops us from addressing the real issues, and it isn't the mining sector. The mining sector boom is other factors.
Like dispossession.
The miners didn't dispossess them. Other people did. But mining actually is giving them work, employment, income, and possibly a future. Okay? But nonetheless, we have to be cognizant of what we can do here. The biggest thing in Western Australia, it will be for the foreseeable future, the mining sector. First, as Andrew indicated, we are finishing the construction boom. It's not finished yet. The largest project ever started on Earth, including the one that went to space, located on Barrow Island, isn't completed yet. Wheatstone, 40, 50 billion, I don't know, has just started. INPEX project, there's a lot of work going on there, and I expect to see the last of the large iron ore mines start up in a couple of months. That is the Roy Hill project. We haven't completed this yet. Iron ore price is $121. But we have invested, I don't know, $300, $400, $500 billion in expanded capacity in the mining sector over the last few years, including in Queensland. And that will generate a large amount of export income, even if the prices come down a bit. And if they do, exchange rate will go down also. So the net earnings will improve. More importantly, there will be huge employments and maintenance and upkeep. I for a while was a shadow on business also, and one of the major areas that we've had, we hear about IT and export orientated. The largest interest in growth here in Western Australia has been people, entrepreneurs taking technology and addressing it to the dominant industry in Western Australia, mining oil and gas, and going to the world. I can give you example after example of people innovating, often small firms, coming up with, let's say, a digital device that goes down a well and can give them all sorts of information about that, and they sell it to every mining site in the world, from Chile to South Africa to Brazil to the Yukon. That's don't underestimate this. It's profound. Yes, when you get big booms like we do, it affects other sections of the economy. It's called the Dutch disease, amongst others. You get distortions. When that boom comes down, there's adjustment and always adjustment costs. We have a sector here that most countries would die for. Most countries who have a sector that booms like this, it destroys their economy. It's called a resource curse. We do it well. We do it well. But it will be a driving sector for diversification and growth, export growth, and total growth for the future. And I think most Western Australians know where their bread is buttered, and we'll know that for a long time. ACT, that's a different story. They have the largest growth industry in Australia.
We've got a few more minutes for the panel, so maybe if each of you can have a concluding comment or question, and then we'll hand over to the audience.
Just briefly on the Aboriginal issue, I think the mining industry is making up for its past misdeeds, I think, and good on the mining industry for doing what they're doing. But you've got to remember when the Pilbara was opened up in the 60s, the mining companies just charged in to Aboriginal land, dug it up and shipped it out. The mining industry wasn't even... The Aboriginal people who had lived on that land for so long weren't even invited into the room when the deals were done to carve up the Pilbara. It was the mining industry who opposed any move towards Aboriginal land rights in the 70s and the 80s. It was the mining industry that opposed the Mabo and the Wick judgments in the 90s. And the mining industry only came round to this idea that it would be good to engage with Aboriginal communities and hire Aborigines in the 90s after they were forced to, in a sense. And they actually came to realise it was also good business practice because it makes sense to employ Aboriginal people who are actually living right next door to your mines. So they are making up for decades of ignoring the plight of Aboriginal people, I think, but there are some really good examples of companies. Yeah, Rio Tinto, who have actually led the way, I think. They've done a lot of good work. And Twiggy, for all his faults, he's out there doing his bit. So, yeah. But I just think we have to look at the history as well.
Yes, thanks, Andrew.
Last words? I'm going to give a plug for this book, because I can. Just two paragraphs, if I may. Which maybe give a little bit of relevance to sitting here on this particular night. two paras from the opening of the book. The Coalition's decisive 2013 election victory in the House of Reps gives it the opportunity to take decisions in the public interest. If it uses... There's two scenarios here. So the first one. If it uses this opportunity to occupy the centre ground in political life and govern with the welfare of the great majority of Australians in mind, it will at once conserve most of the gains in our standard of living for the past 22 years and entrench itself in power for a long period. That's scenario one. Alternatively, if it seeks to govern in the interests of its most powerful supporters, it will not be able to lead Australia away from rising unemployment, large falls in living standards, social tension, growing dissatisfaction with our institutions. Its lifespan is likely to be short. The key phrase there, if it seeks to govern in the interests of its most powerful supporters... I know in my heart which scenario this government's already chosen. If there's anything that you in this audience can do to help us shorten its lifespan, I would greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. Andrew? Timing is everything.
So I want to think about the challenge facing Australia as being the challenge of two sporting codes, AFL and English Premier League. In English Premier League, one team, Manchester United, has won 12 out of the last 20 seasons. By some estimates, half of all English Premier League fans are Man U fans. In AFL, no team has won more than 3 out of the last 20 seasons. And you've got teams like the Crows who go from the bottom to the top to the bottom again at the ladder. Now, that's not an accident. In AFL, they share the TV revenues. In English Premier League, you keep it to yourself. In AFL, you've got a salary cap. In English Premier League, you pay what you like. And in AFL, you've got a draft where the low-ranked teams pick the players. And in English Premier League, the scouts scour the globe. AFL is a more exciting game because there's a little bit of redistribution in it. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question for Australia is whether we want to go down the path of English Premier League or down the path of AFL.
Thanks, so, Andrew. Ross?
When are the Dockers going to win flag, Dan?
Well, these days I live in Carlton but continue to barrack for the Eagles. And I would have liked 2000 to win in 2005 and make it 4, Andrew.
Touched the nerve,
I'd like to conclude by going back to the things that Scott said and agree with some of them and disagree.
That's because I read your words.
disagree with others. And I suppose on the points of disagreement, I'm speaking for the right-hand half of the couch, the people with PhDs in economics at the ANU or professors at
the
ANU. I don't think the choice is between economic growth properly defined and catastrophic pressure on natural systems. Certainly the way, without changing technology and changing the way we do a lot of things, there is a conflict. But I think that we've done enough work on the technology of development, enough work on the economics of changing technology to know that we could, for example, on climate change, continue economic growth, but modify the way we do things in a way that avoided catastrophic effects. And what carbon pricing does do is introduce incentives for people to make those adjustments. So we will not take away from the 85% of humanity that do not yet enjoy high living standards, the aspiration to enjoy those living standards. They will, the people of India, of Africa, will aspire to our standards of living. We have to set in train the changes that break the nexus between rising living standards and catastrophic pressures on the environment. Nick Stern's work, my work in the two climate change reviews, shows that we can do that at reasonable cost. So that's a bit I'm disagreeing with Scott on. On the point, I'd agree with him. I think it would be a terrible shame for the global effort to deal in dealing with climate change, and also for the Australian economy, for us to repeal the legislation on carbon pricing from 2011. It is doing the job in the electricity sector. Well, the whole set of policies, not simply carbon pricing, the whole set of policies has led to a fall in emissions from our electricity sector by over 7% in the first year of operation of the new set of policies after many years of rapid increases. The whole structure is designed to allow adjustments to take place smoothly in future, for us to increase our effort, as other countries do, at moderate cost. And simply looking at the budget impact of the change of loss of all that revenue from sale of permits and having to take up costs of direct action would add multiple billions per annum of pressure to the budget, increasing over time after the four-year estimate. Now, we've got a very big budget problem in Australia. The Audit Commission on the Budget is going to have to cut and cut a lot of awful things, even without changing from the current arrangements, which contribute a lot of revenue to the government, to other arrangements which cost a lot of revenue. Add to that getting rid of carbon pricing and the budget cuts that will be necessary to maintain reasonable fiscal shape will be very much more painful for the Australian community. So I think we face a very important choice on this question in the period ahead.
Thanks, Ross. Mm. Mike?
Yeah, we've gone through a great times, in at least in Western Australia, something actually we have prepared for 20, 30 years. And the boom's coming off, and that boom pulled resources in the mining sector that left other sectors. I didn't see too many professors of economics working up in the mines when I visited it, but it affected those sectors indirectly. And there will be some adjustment. And we are a successful nation because of the reforms that Ross mentions in great detail. It was remarkable how we as a nation did that. We've done most of the easy ones. You always choose the lowest hanging fruit. The difficult ones are in front of us. How do you get an effective world-class educational system in primary and secondary area? That's hard. It's very hard. And let's debate that. There is no one solution. And we have to do those a range of things. But all I plead for, at least from the perspective of Western Australia, don't throw the baby out with the dishwater or bathwater. The mining sector has contributed greatly, and it will in the future. Dream large, but don't go chasing dreams. Think it through. Debate. Make sure you do the right thing. One of Ross's themes we haven't dealt with in great detail over the last few years, there hasn't only been a reduction in a pursuit of productivity improvements, but the quality of a lot of the policies and the policy arguments that surrounded them have been absolutely horrendous. Okay? And we need to get back to those long debates. One of the big ones we did is strip away the protectionist policies that kind of hemmed in Australia. We're still suffering it from the car industry. But that took 20 years to do. Real hard debate and work on it. We have a lot of challenges there, more difficult than that, and we need a good debate about it. And what we need is sounder debate. Often you don't get that in Parliament. You might not have noticed that. We need that thing. But the mining sector, geez, that's our comparative advantage, and it has many spin-offs. Just go down. Yes, West Perth has a lot of vacancies, but I tell you what, I've been in this game a long time, and I have never seen the diversity and support base from the drilling, the geophysics, the electronic ones supporting that sector, not only in Western Australia, but Africa and Asia. Ausdrill, big mining firm, has twice as many people working in Africa than they do in Australia right now. That's where our comparative advantage lies, amongst other things.
Thank you, Mike. Mm-hmm. Please join me in thanking the panellists. Andrew, I may have sold you a little short, given that you had the first of the last without probably realising that you did. So someone please ask Andrew a question so that we can balance it up. It's now over to you. We have about 15 minutes for questions. And I'll do my best to see. There's a microphone coming here to the lady, second row, I think, just behind you there. Yes?
Yes, thank you for an interesting debate tonight. I have a comment first to make, perhaps towards Dr. Nahan, and then I'll go on to another question, that I've noticed that Halliburton, who's somewhat dubious repute, is in there like Flynn to bring its drilling rigs for the unconventional gas industry. So I don't know what that does for our local infrastructure producing, an American firm. Now, the other question that I have, and I listened to Christine Lagarde from the IMF last night, and she was very emphatic on the need for the environment, the degradation of the environment, to be taken into account in the cost-benefit analysis of She didn't particularly say the mining industry, but I am thinking of the mining industry. And if that was taken into account, which it must be, what would that mean for us, for the mining sector and other sectors? Thank you.
Thank you. Open to the panel, that one. Anyone want to?
Yeah, Halliburton doesn't actually own or operate drilling rigs. They supply some of the services that go through in the drilling process. It's a big U.S. firm, but in terms of shale gas, that has revolutionized will continue to do so, gas around the world. And it has not only been that shale gas revolution has led to the largest reduction in carbon emissions in the U.S. in its history. In fact, it's more than meeting its Kyoto targets without doing very much except discovering a lot of gas that's replacing coal. So I hope we do a lot of drilling, and I hope we do get shale gas in the States, with or without Halliburton.
Could I give a slightly different view? it's interesting to twin those two questions together, because I think, with greatest respect to Dr. Nahan, you just heard a benefit analysis and not a cost-benefit analysis. And what price groundwater, what price healthy aquifers and a farming and pastoral industries? I think carbon pricing was a crude attempt to put a price on dumping CO2 into the atmosphere, that should cost something. And so I think there is a place for it. I also think, you could do a cost-benefit analysis on removing your kidneys and putting yourself on dialysis. You could actually, what would it cost to put myself on dialysis and be carted around by these horrible machines for the rest of my life? It's very difficult to monetize the cost of, healthy atmosphere, healthy water. I hope we keep the fracking industry the hell out of Western Australia for those reasons.
Anyone else at this point? We'll keep going, I think. Who's got the microphone now? Question? There's somebody right up there. Central section. Looks like a black shirt.
Thank you. Could the a question to the panel. We hear about the big export industry that is going to occur in the next decade or so. What is the best way of taxing mining companies? Do you tax them on the profits made by the stuff they dig up and send overseas? Or do you tax them on the amount they dig up and pay them and charge them royalties?
Andrew,
So the answer that was given by Sarah Palin while she was governor of Alaska was that it made no sense to charge the same amount per unit of a resource if you thought that the price was set by world markets. So the way in which Palin made her name as governor of Alaska was putting in place a profits-based resource tax. She didn't do it because she's a raving socialist. She did it because it's a more effective way of taxing commodities. Unless you think that the ingenuity of our miners, and there's plenty of that, actually drives the world price, then you ought to believe that when the world price goes up tenfold, that taxpayers ought to get some share of that increase in world prices. Indeed, that's why the Minerals Council of Australia went to the 2009 Henry Review recommending a profits-based tax. Now, we can have plenty of discussions about designs, and I'm very happy to admit that where we got to was not the world's most perfect profits-based mining tax. But I do think the notion of profits-based mining tax is real economics 101.
Yeah. Ross?
Long before Kevin Rudd and then Julia Gillard asked me to advise on climate change, I wrote a number of articles and a book about the best way of doing this, and Governor Palin's officials relied rather heavily on my book.
Right, that's right. Very cool.
A form of cash flow-based tax, profits-based tax, with certain characteristics is the right way of doing this. It means that you will not be deterring economically valuable mines that happen to have high costs but can make a large positive contribution to the economy at the same time as you collect for the state a reasonable proportion of the value of resources which are owned by the people of the state and made available to the mining companies. The mineral resources of Western Australia are owned by the Crown, and the Crown sells state property when it makes a lease of iron ore or gold-bearing country to a mining company. I guess Mike has responsibility for that now for mineral leasing, but when he signs a lease over to a company, he's handing over a bit of valuable state property. If the government owns land, it's a scandal if that's handed over without proper process and at a reasonable price. It should be a scandal if mineral resources owned by the people of the state are handed over at less than the true value, and the way of determining true value is through a properly structured resource rent tax.
Thank you. Andrew?
I've covered this resources tax debate for a few years now. Andrew called it not the best example of the way to introduce a resources tax. I'd call it probably the worst example of public policy in recent Australian history, because by now the RSPT, which was the original resources tax, was meant to be collecting billions of dollars. Whether you think the RSPT was correct or not, let's just focus on the fact that right now, in 2014, it's meant to be collecting billions of dollars in revenue for the federal government. In the face of a fierce campaign from big mining companies, the former Labor government abolished the RSPT and introduced a watered-down tax called the Minerals Resource Rent Tax, which they basically let Rio Tinto and BHP design for themselves. Now, I went back and checked the numbers today. When Wayne Swan announced the MRRT in November 2011, the forecast was for that tax to be collecting $4 billion this financial year. I went back and I checked the half-yearly profit reports for BHP, Rio and Fortescue today. None of those big companies, the big, big iron ore companies making the biggest profits and exporting all the iron ore, none of them paid a cent in MRRT for the first half of this year. It'll collect virtually nothing. It's a massive failure. And I think it's something that the previous government should be really ashamed of.
So, folks, did anybody hear Liberal Senator Matthias Cormann over the last 24 hours say that a future WA by-election will be a referendum on the minerals resource rent tax? Shall we see if we can prove him right? can we really serve that up? Did you notice how we've got this gargantuan sandpit out on the Esplanade in Perth, and our light rail got cancelled? You know, there's actually a lot of stuff that this state is going without because that tax collected almost no revenue at all. So if they want to make it a referendum on that, I reckon we should just say, OK, I'm up for it.
Okay. Let me go back to the issue on hand. How do you optimally tax minerals? And Ross's first set of work was on this area. Indeed, I did my PhD with his good friend Craig Emerson, and Craig did it on the same topic. And I negotiated the first profit-based royalty at Burrow Island when I was a bureaucrat in the mid-80s. I also undertook a review of the mineral royalties in Western Australia. Craig was involved. He was advising the then Minister for Mines. And we did all sorts of work on this issue. And it's complicated, as everything, as his life is. Ross's point is first, a royalty is a payment for access to a government, in Australia, a state-owned asset. And the question is, how do you charge for that? Another thing is, how do you get the optimal money out of sometimes profitable businesses? I might add, in the 90s, mining was not profitable. It has been very profitable here. You do get some, it's called a company tax. You get some profit there. Second, you can have a top-up specific tax to collect the super profits the mining firms, and particularly oil and gas firms, often earn. But these are hellishly complex, or else you can destroy it by not having the correct deductions and treatments right. And that's what Andrew was dealing with, that whole tax structures that was put forward, even the first one. The second one was, I agree with Andrew, the worst public policy that I can remember at all. The previous one had its flaws, but if you don't get these things right and you're trying to capture that rent, you won't capture the value of the resource. In the mining sector, in the iron ore sector, the real gain is not the ore body. There's plenty of iron ore, 61% iron ore around. It's the infrastructure that goes into it. And that's why we benefited rather than Africa and other places. We had that all ready to go and could expand it. So it's complicated, but profit-based royalties with potentially upfront bidding, bidding for access to it, is the optimal way to go often.
Okay, thank you. Sorry. Just one more question then and we'll conclude. Over here, someone has the microphone already there. That's nine-tenths of the law.
Thank you. A friend's father often used to quote to him that he said, you may need a surgeon perhaps once in your life. You may need a firefighter maybe, you know, once in your life if you're unlucky. But three times a day, every day of your life, you'll need a farmer. And my question would be perhaps directed both to Scott and to Ross to comment on perhaps the state of agriculture, both in Australia but also in Western Australia. And as a farmer myself and from the southwest with my family here, it's particularly tough to farm in a way, I suppose, that's non-industrial, that's not polluting and certainly not cruel. And so when we talk about, and Scott, I'm reading into some of your comments, I suppose, that there are other values at stake here and agriculture is not exempt for that. And I'd just like to appreciate some comments on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Scott.
Great. Last question.
Yes.
It's a great place to finish up.
Well, others may want to comment.
But no, I just it's a good conversation to finish up with. I think your primary question was, you know, what do you think of the state of farming here on the East Coast? And I think it's in a great degree of trouble. Farmers now exposed to a multitude of pressures, whether it be world commodity markets or the gyrations of what was already a pretty extreme climate becoming even more extreme before our eyes. The fact that a thing called competition policy appears to have virtually annihilated competition and consolidated control in two major supermarket chains, which has put a huge amount of pressure on people who are trying to sell into the domestic market. We took a variety, I don't know if anybody heard about them, but we took a variety of policies to the last federal election around regional resilience. Now, it can be as simple as local processing hubs and kind of collective resources in regional towns to help people who are trying to produce for domestic markets, to maintaining the Tier 3 rail lines in the wheat belt for grain exporters who are watching regional roads disintegrate and near misses on regional roads. That's public infrastructure for public good. I think the most urgent thing probably is to try and work out how the hell to keep people on the land as the climate dries out. Well, we're witnessing what might be the permanent evacuation of northern, you know, parts of the northern wheat belt at the moment because it just won't rain. So if you take it that there's a public interest case in being able to retain some domestic food growing capability that we're not going to be able to survive on processed stuff imported from elsewhere, then I think we do owe farmers a public debt for providing a public good, and there's a multitude of different ways that we can do that, including maybe introducing energy crops into your rotation, whether it be a wind farm or in the wheat belt, introducing oil mallee cropping for energy and activated carbon. There's a lot of good ideas out there, but it's just getting them through. The first thing we've got to do, sorry if I'm taking too much time, you know, watching Barnaby Joyce traipse around on the East Coast into communities being hit by drought, going, goodness, we could never have seen this coming. It kind of breaks your heart. We've got to snap out of the denial that people are really up against the wall in some parts of the country.
Yeah, the CSIRO lists as the first of their number one global mega challenges, as they call it.
Right.
Yes, Rob?
I'll address the part of the question related to needing a farmer three times a day and whether we've all got enough to eat three times a day, I think, has to be looked at as a global question. Globally, the world did pretty well. The 70s, 80s, 90s, the average rate of growth in agricultural production substantially exceeded growth in population. We are running into greater challenges in the early 21st century. Yeah, we're not getting the same productivity growth in agriculture. I was for a number of years the chairman of the International Food Policy Research Institute based in Washington, and this is before my work on climate change, but globally we saw the biggest long-term risk to feeding a growing world population coming from climate change. That early work showed that the climate change was going to have different effects in different parts of the world. There could even be positive effects in some parts of the world, but there was a big negative effect in three parts of the world, one of which was thought not to be very important by all of my colleagues working on these things, and that was Australia. The others were South Asia, with nearly a quarter, or over 20% of the world's people, and then the sub-Saharan Africa. Climate change will shift the places where you can undertake certain types of agriculture, and human population has grown around the current distribution of rainfall and temperature. And so if you get a shift in the water flows down the Yangtze and the Yellow River, the Indus River, the Brahmaputri, the Ganges, which are all fed through patterns of winter rainfall and then melting of ice in the spring and summer, human civilization has developed around the reliability of those systems, and they're all threatened by climate change. And here in Australia, we are mostly living, most of us Australians, in the southern part of the continent, because you had the reliable winter rainfall from the westerly winds. Well, one of the most of the effects of climate change are anticipated to be in the longer-term future. There's about a 30-year lag between increases in emissions and its effect on climate. So what's gone up in the atmosphere in the last 10 years will have its main effect in 20 years' time. But already there are a number of signatures of climate change in patterns of climate, and one of the science says that one of the clear signals is the drying of the south of Western Australia. If you look at the numbers, temperature decade by decade, well, West Australia is not very different from the rest of the world, rising average temperature decade by decade the last 5 decades. Look at rainfall in the areas from, well, say from Geraldton south, that's been falling decade by decade. Even more importantly, when you get a combination of falling rainfall and higher temperature, you get quicker evaporation, more complete evaporation of the rain that does fall, and so you get much less runoff into creeks and streams, much less runoff into dams, and so there's a dramatic fall in decade by decade from when I was a kid here in the 50s to today in the flow of water into the dams of Perth. And as Scott said, that is really shrinking the wheat belt, dragging the wheat belt into a smaller number of areas. There will need to be. There is some possibility in some of these areas, and he's mentioned the northern wheat belt, of developing alternative crops that are not dependent on so much rain. Southern Australian agriculture is severely threatened by unmitigated climate change, and for this reason, amongst many others, Australia has a very powerful interest, and West Australia has a very powerful interest in the success of the global effort to avoid dangerous climate change.
Now, last word to Andrew. Thank you.
So the story of Western Australian agriculture is a story of ingenuity, much more so than for farming in other parts of the country. This is a supercontinent that's one of the oldest in the world, somewhere between 3 and 3.2 billion years, which is sort of a source of pride, perhaps, but also a source of really awful soils, lacking things like phosphorus, nitrogen, copper. And so that's meant that Western Australian agriculture has had to be much smarter, and initiatives like the pipeline and the inland rail have been vital. But it also means that we have to be open to science-based alternatives to boost productivity in the future. And I find it sort of deeply frustrating as a centrist politician to sit in the federal parliament with people on my right who argue that climate change isn't happening and humans don't have a role to play and we shouldn't take the most effective and efficient way of dealing with it, and people on my left who don't want to pursue the potential and the next green revolution around genetically modified seeds and don't want to follow a science-based approach to GM, but instead want to believe... So one group want to believe the scientists on GM but not on climate change. The other one want to believe the scientists on climate change but not GM. I'd much rather have a science-based approach across the board.
Thank you. I'm sure that that's a discussion that could go on all night.
Yeah, that's
all by
a whole
itself.
Another night. We could fill the auditorium up on that one.
I could see Andrew giving a bit of a poke on the way out, so thank you for that. Thank you indeed for coming this evening, and thank you for the questions, which have broadened the discussion. And I'd like you to join me too in expressing your appreciation to our excellent panel. Thank you very much.